Good afternoon, members and the public. We are convening the meeting of the Transportation Policy and Transit Division, an oversight division for today, February 4th, 2009. We do have a quorum, I believe, and so I think Representative Rosenthal seems very eager to move our minutes today, so I will call on him for that motion. Representative Rosenthal moves the minutes. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion carries. And we have a busy agenda today, members. We're going to hear two overview presentations rounding out our transit orientation. One from the county's Transit Improvement Board, and then the other from the Transit Office for Greater Minnesota, which is housed at MnDOT. Now, we do have a bill which generated a lot of interest, House File 116. I hope to get to that by about 10 of 2, if we can stay focused here. And so we'll have those overview presentations again for roughly the first 45 minutes, and then we'll take the bill for the balance of the meeting. And I think we're just waiting on the final computer setup here. And
I think we're ready.
Oh, one moment, Commissioner. We do have, again, I was reminded by our staff for our weekly reminder on the electronic cell phones off and other portable electronic devices. I feel like I'm on a flight that's under 10,000 feet. But we'd like to have you refrain from that. It interferes with our recording, and I've also been told by our staff that for some reason in this committee it's been hard to hear on the tape, so make sure both testifiers and members that you speak into the microphone, and I know a lot of us do this, but it doesn't always pick up. So with that reminder, I think we're ready to go, and I'd like to warmly welcome Commissioner Peter McLaughlin to our committee. I can think of no individual in the region who's done more to promote transitways in his capacity both as a legislator. You know, he was a member here until 1990, from 1984 to 1990, and particularly in his role as a member of the Hennepin County Board. I don't know how many meetings about transit you've been at, how much time you've put into this, but again, members, there's just no one in the region who's done more, I think. And so when Congressman Oberstar maybe half-jokingly said he'd like to appoint, have Commissioner McLaughlin appointed to the FTA, I think there is someone else, so we don't want to start rumors, but this is a guy that has had, I think, national impact on transit. So thanks so much for being here and for making the time in your busy schedule, and we look forward to hearing about CTIP.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'd just like to ask you, everyone here in the room who's been in the Meeker County Courthouse, please raise their hand.
So, members, I think that unprompted by me, Representative Erdahl is proving the point about Commissioner McLaughlin's tireless advocacy of transportation across the state.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. It was about a year ago that I paid that visit. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm Peter McLaughlin. I'm chair of the Hennepin County Regional Railroad Authority and the Hennepin County, or the County Transit Improvement Board. And I'm here today as part of our effort to fulfill the statutory requirement that County Transit Improvement Board annually report to the legislature on its activity. We have a little different, we changed the color on this presentation, and we can't seem to find that particular version. So you've got a green version, and it's essentially the same as the one that I'm going to go through here today. So we just changed the background on it, and I'm sorry we don't have that, didn't get the right one to come up here. So, Mr. Chairman, the history here was that the legislature voted to approve the transportation bill last year, overriding the governor's veto on February 25th. And in 8 months and 4 days, the five counties opted to organize themselves in a joint powers agreement. They opted to impose a quarter cent sales tax And we did that essentially from a blank piece of paper, and we developed the Joint Powers Agreement, and by October 29th of last year, 8 months and 4 days later, we were able to approve $86 million in grants for the improvement of transit in the region and to make a payment to the Metropolitan Council. So we made, I think, remarkable progress in a very, very short period of time. And our first comment today would be to thank the legislature for trusting the counties in the metropolitan area to put this together and to try to carry forward our efforts to invest in transit. So we appreciate that, and we believe we've lived up to your trust, and we want to continue to do that. The history is that five counties out of the seven that were eligible, Scott and Carver being the two that opted not to participate, but five counties created a joint powers agreement, Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington. We called ourselves the County Transit Improvement Board. We set criteria and award grants for transit improvements from the sales tax revenue. There's weighted voting among the five counties as provided by statute, and we created a grant evaluation and ranking systems committee that included municipal officials as well as county officials in the Met Council to make recommendations. The membership of the County Transit Improvement Board, Mr. Chairman and members, two county commissioners from each county and the chair of the Metropolitan Council, from 11-person board. There are 100 votes on the board. 95 of those votes are allocated among the five participating counties, and 5 votes were allocated to the Metropolitan Council. The 95 votes are allocated based on a weighted voting system based 50% on sales tax revenue produced in the individual counties and 50% based on the population of the county.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, can any two counties with their weighted voting percent break 50%?
Mr. Chairman and
McLaughlin.
Representative Holbert, yes, but we acknowledge that problem. And what we did is, this is a little bit like creating the Constitution of the United States, trying to weigh the interests of big counties and little counties, counties that were further more developed in their projects and those that weren't. And so we said that for any vote, if you want to set the agenda for the meeting, you have to have 63 votes out of 100. And you have to have the votes of at least 3 counties. So no two counties, even if they could get to 63 votes, can pass anything. You've got to have 3 counties voting for anything, and you've got to have 63 votes. And in the event of a commitment of a significant amount of money over a long period of time, for instance, if the County Transit Improvement Board were to authorize the sale of bonds, and the sale was in excess of essentially $100 million, and it was going to be for a term in excess of 5 years. So we're essentially obligating the board and this revenue stream for a long period of time for a lot of money. We required a super-duper majority, we called it, 75 votes, and the votes of 3 counties. Your question, I will tell you, we started, as I said, with a blank piece of paper. The first meeting of the representatives of the 7 counties had, there were 85 people. I mean, there were the county attorneys were represented, the budget people and the transit people from the counties. And so, yeah, those are good questions, and we chewed them over very hard. I can tell you that in the 9-10 months that we've been in operation, virtually every significant vote has been unanimous. And so there have been some procedural votes and other things that where we've actually gotten to the details of voting. But I think we did a good job with a hard task of balancing the interests of the large and the small counties. Hennepin County represents it's like 43% of the population and produces 55% of the revenue. And so it's trying to balance that with a county that produces only 5% of the revenue is really what we were trying to do, to make sure that the interests of all were protected.
And Mr. Chair and Commissioner, do you off the top of your head know the points that each county has?
No, I used to have that slide tacked on the end. They are in the annual report, which was in your packet.
I'll find it then. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't have it off the top of my head. I knew it when we were negotiating. I'll tell you.
Thank you.
So here's the process that we established. The County Transit Improvement Board sets the criteria for the grants based on statute, the Joint Powers Agreement, and our assessment of what the priorities ought to be. Local governmental units can submit applications for funds. Private companies cannot apply. It's got to be a governmental unit. It could be the Met Council. It could be an individual county or a city. Then there's the GEARS committee, does an evaluation and makes a recommendation of the project. And then it goes then to the County Transit Improvement Board to determine a budget and to grant the award. The awards that we make have to be consistent with the Metropolitan Council's 2030 plan, so that our investments have to be consistent with the regional vision that was provided by statute, and we agreed to that as the bill was going through. And so we make the grant awards. So the grant awards are made by a vote of 10 elected officials and the chair of the Met Council. Those are the 11 people on the board, with the recommendations coming from the GEARS committee, which includes municipal officials as well as Met Council and county officials. And I'm here today as a part of the reports of the legislature. And then the grants are actually administered by either a county rail authority or the Metropolitan Council. We said we were going to be lean and mean. We weren't going to create a new layer of government. We were going to evaluate projects, make grant awards, and actually stand up and take the votes for the tax so that there was actually revenue available.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, if I might. And then how does the voting work on the GEARS committee, and why do we see some counties with more city representatives than others, and how is that determined?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbert, the membership of the GEARS committee and the balance was dictated specifically in statute, the one that was passed last year. And so it was some reflection of population and other things. The actual distribution, AMM actually held the election for us, and they determined, for example, in Hennepin County there were two city representatives, and they determined three representatives, and they decided how to divide the county up so that all regions of the county would be guaranteed representation. So that was handed off. First, the statute directed that there'd be a GEARS committee, directed what the membership would be, and then AMM handled the election.
And if I might, just one more question. Is their voting weighted as well, or is it they all have an individual vote?
It's individual votes, but there's some weighting. Some of the larger counties get more votes on there than the other counties. I can show you here. Here's the representation up on the screen of the GEARS committee.
Yeah, and I have it.
You've
in
got
the annual report here.
But it's not as formal. It's only they're providing a recommendation. They're not making the final decision. And so the vote, we didn't think that the voting needed to be as finely tuned as we did when we were actually making the final allocation of funds. But they make a recommendation. There's a rough weighting here, but not as finely tuned.
Right, thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, here's the membership. I'll go back. These are the county commissioners who are on the board. As you see, Peter Bell represents the council. And Carver and Scott County participated in all the meetings for the development of the Joint Powers Agreement. There were active participants, and in the course of those discussions, we made a decision that we would invite them to participate in the County Transit Improvement Board as non-voting members. So there are Carver and Scott County representatives who sit at the table at every one of our meetings, and that, I think, is a positive thing. There again is the GEARS committee that makes recommendations. So the sales tax is a dedicated source of transitway funding, a quarter of a cent sales tax, and $20 per vehicle sale by auto dealers. So, but if, for example, if I sold you a car, Representative Holbert, there'd be no $20 fee. But if I bought one from XYZ car dealer, then I would have to pay the $20 fee. The effect is a nickel on a $20 purchase. The anticipated revenues are $2 billion over the next two decades. So if you think about the Met Council's 2030 plan that you're going to hear about, that you heard about last week, rather, we'll have $2 billion to contribute to the realization of that plan. The benefit to the region from this having this sales tax available is it increases, number one, increases our ability to compete for federal funds. The federal funds on these New START projects, like Central Corridor, like North Star, 50% of the money for those projects is coming from the federal government. By having a dedicated funding source, we're better able to compete. A reliable, dedicated funding source for the local share of that, a portion of the local share of that project, that's going to allow us to compete better for federal funds. It reduces property taxes by funding 50% of the transitway operating costs and reducing the rail authority's share of capital costs to 10%. Sales tax also reduces the state capital share of these projects to 10%, having been 33% previously. Again, it maximizes it. These are the criteria that we're using. Some of these come from the statute. Some of them come from the Joint Powers Agreement. But we're maximizing the use and availability of federal funds. Specifically in statute, it provides that the sales tax dollars may not supplant Met Council's capital funding or operating funding. Any grants we make have to be consistent with the Met Council's transportation policy plan, and we require a 10% local match from the rail authorities for any capital grant that's received. We provide that no grants for operating costs except for projects that have been supported by the County Transit Improvement Board or some pre-existing projects like Hiawatha, North Star, Cedar Avenue BRT, and the I-35W BRT. So we are making a contribution to the operation of each of those corridors out of the sales tax. So it is not accurate to say that the sales tax money is not being used for operating costs. It, in fact, is being used to pay for a 50% share of the operating costs of these transitways that have been funded, and that would be the same with Central Corridor if that were when that completed in 2014. We also agreed that there must be an annual grant to each county member that's at least 1% of the sales tax proceeds for fiscal years 2009, 10, and 11. This was designed specifically to guarantee that Washington County, which didn't have projects teed up and ready to go for capital investment, that they could receive a grant, which in this year totaled about $950,000. And so that was a guarantee. They wanted that kind of a guarantee, and I think it worked out well. You'll see from the grants that we provided. Finally, the applicants have to be state or local political subdivisions. What we did in terms of allocating funds this year, the $86 million, we established an interim transit investment framework. We weren't trying to make long-term decisions because we wanted to have a financial plan for the long-term, but there were some projects that needed investment in the short-term, and we thought it was a good idea to do that. So we said we defined what transitways were, which are LRT lines, BRT lines, commuter rail lines where there's a major investment in capital, not your garden variety express bus line. We committed specifically to attaining geographic equity over time in the grants that we make so that all parts of the region will participate. You can't build every line all at once, but we did commit over the long haul to geographic equity. And then we had financial people in to make sure that we would have what did the financial analysis, and we were frankly very conservative in our analysis, very conservative to make sure that we would have the funds available to distribute. In addition to that, we said we were going to make a funding commitment, long-term funding commitment, and that was the Central Corridor, up to $300 million for Central Corridor, which represents a 30% of the total cost of that line, and this was a way to lock in the local share so that we could compete effectively for the federal money. By having that locked in, we had an application that was ready to go at the federal level, and we got a much better grade from the federal government as we competed for the 50% share because we had that local share in place. And we approved that interim plan on the 20th of August of this year, And then we made grants at the end of October. First, we funded the Fridley Station, the restoration of the Fridley Station on the North Star Corridor. The Fridley Station was eliminated from North Star in order to meet the cost effectiveness index. It was a high ridership station, and by making this investment at this time, the Fridley Station can open when the North Star Corridor opens up for operations late in 2009. The same is true of the Cedar Avenue BRT, the Apple Valley Station there, where we made those were both investments that needed to be made this year so that when the facilities open, these two stations would be in place and ready to go. We made a commitment, a down payment on our 30% commitment to Central Corridor of $26 million. That's almost 10% of the county's Transit Improvement Board total commitment to that project. And CTIB is going to be providing 60% of the local share for that project. And as I said, in the New Starts application that went in, we could show 100% of the local money was in place. That was a first at this stage in the development of a rail line. So that helped us a great deal in our competition for the federal money. Here's just a little illustration of what happens with the money because the sales tax is in place. Hiawatha, that's there for illustrative purposes. That one we kind of created out of whole cloth, and it's been a great success, but we were making it up as we went along. Some of the people in this room helped make it up, and so we appreciate the support that was there. But if you look at North Star, that was a model that was in place before the sales tax. 50% of the money from the feds, 33% from the state, and 17% from the county rail authority. The Central Corridor model, which now has the county's Transit Improvement Board money in it, has, again, 50% federal, 30% from the county Transit Improvement Authority Board, rather, 10% from the county rail authorities, and 10% from state bonds. So the state counties now provide 80% to the county Transit Improvement Board and the rail authority, 80% of the non-federal share. The state share has been reduced by two-thirds, and the property tax has been reduced, property tax through the rail authorities has been reduced by 41%. So that's what the shift represents. We made some operating grants, and the biggest one was $30.8 million to the Metropolitan Council, provided by statute, one-time operating funding to help Met Council with their operating deficit, is frankly what's keeping the buses running right now by Metro Transit. We made the operating cost, 50% of the operating cost of Hiawatha, 50% of the operating cost of North Star were paid out of these grant monies, so we're making almost, or in excess of $40 million worth of operating cost contributions to the transit system this year, as well as making the partial year payments for the operations of the 35W South BRT line and the Cedar Avenue BRT line. Those are both partial year payments.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Can you tell me, at least for Hennepin County and if you know for the other four counties, did any of them reduce their rail authority levy as a result of having the sales tax money?
Mr. Chairman, I am proud to say that Hennepin County reduced our rail authority levy by $8 million.
And
by virtue of because of this sales tax money.
And do you know about what the percent of the total levy that was? I don't know what the size.
It was about 50% reduction in levy.
And do you know any of the other counties did the same?
Anoka did some. I can't quote you the number. Maybe Mr. Schreiner.
Representative Holbert, I can give you an article on the Anoka County reduction. It was also substantial.
Okay, good. I am glad to hear that. Thank you.
Ms. Chairman, and Representative Holberg, you've heard me at this table say that I didn't think that the property tax was the way to pay for these operating costs and that it was never part of the original agreement for Hiawatha. And so we wanted to live up to that spirit of that by showing a reduction, this $8 million reduction in our property taxes.
Right, well, and Mr. Chair, we heard a lot from the cities on the road side of things, too, that if this bill passed, we'd see reduced levy as a result of more money going to transportation. I'm not sure we've seen that come to fruition, so I'm glad, at least in the case of the Rail Authority and in a couple counties, it did.
Well, Ms. Chairman, the only counties that had substantial operating costs at this point were Hennepin and Anoka. They were a little central corridor hadn't actually started up and operating, but now built into those pro formas, and the Ramsey County Rail Authority will have a reduced property tax contribution that they'll have to make.
And Mr. Chair, I recognize that, but all five counties, the taxpayers are paying more, and so to mitigate some of that off of the property tax, I think, was only being fair to the tax.
I agree. I was an enthusiastic supporter of the motion to make the cut.
Representative Champion.
Forgive me first for coming in late because I was at another commitment, unfortunately. And so perhaps you, Commissioner, have touched on this, but there are three questions that I have right now. So the first question that I have goes back to your slide that covers the interim transit investment framework, and I see language specifically there that says county's transit improvement board will consider geographic equity over time in assessing investment opportunities and grant eligibility. So I would like for you to tell me what that really means, you know, when we say that. And the second question that would be tied to that is whether this board or this coming together, if there's some consideration to land use connected to economic development and distressed communities and how that works together and how those things were considered when you thought about this broad plan that I hear you so eloquently talking about. And the final question that I have is, you talked about operating costs and that being connected to Met Council, and perhaps I hope that I'm on the right page as far as this concern. But if that is true, when we think in terms of the county putting up dollars in order to help with the operating costs of Met Council, what considerations were put forward when we think in terms of decreased service and routes in a distressed area such as 58B and how that rendering was going to be helpful to those who are dependent upon transportation in order to get to the places of spaces where there are job opportunities?
Commissioner McLaughlin. Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion. Let me try to take those in order. The geographic equity, I addressed it just briefly, but we have always aspired to a metropolitan-wide system. We're creating a system. The Washington, D.C. system is now approaching its 30th birthday. It took a while to get it built, but now it actually does a pretty good job of covering that region with the exception of Georgetown, and they opted out at the beginning. We are aspiring to just that kind of metropolitan-wide coverage. And so, having said that, we can't build in every corner of the region at once. And so we have had three lines that have been percolating for the last decade, Hiawatha, North Star and Central, and now we are in the process of identifying what the next generation of investments is going to be. There's been great concern about the east side of the metro, that they get a fair share of the investment, because I believe that these investments are important to the economic future of cities, neighborhoods, and the regions through which they pass. And so we're very cognizant of that. We've had extensive discussion, and we're trying to reflect that in our long-term financial plan. The short-term, this interim transit investment framework, we were trying to do projects that had some time sensitivity associated with them. We made the biggest commitment that we made in that was the $300 million for Central Corridor. So, and that is, it's my way of thinking, the essential reach into the East Metro area, and that's important to make that fundamental core investment, and we did make that investment. In terms of your concerns about land use and economic development, those issues, because of the way the federal government, the Federal Transit Administration, has interpreted what they call the cost effectiveness index, they have given much shorter shrift to land use and economic development considerations than, I would argue, the Congress intended by the statute, and frankly, in listening to Congressman Oberstar, shorter shrift than the current administration and the current Congress are going to want. And so I think some of the concerns that you raise about tying this to economic development, you and others have raised about tying these decisions to economic development, I think there's going to be more room to do that in the new year here because of changes in Washington. And we are going to be working on that. In terms of, when I was in the legislature, I chose as a freshman, and the speaker at the time, Speaker Jennings, obliged me by putting me on the Transportation Committee. And there were not a lot of urban members on that committee at that time, I will tell you. And I did it because my district, which Representative Hayden now represents, my district had the highest transit usage of any legislative district in the state of Minnesota. So my district is similar to your district. And so the concerns that you raise are important, and we're looking at the Bottineau corridor, which is going to serve your district. And that is an important corridor, and the Hennepin County has invested money to get that corridor teed up. We haven't had federal help, we haven't had state help on that, but we're investing in that corridor so that it can be teed up for consideration in the future. So that's how we're trying to aspire to get these things that kind of go like this. You never can quite predict which one's going to emerge. The fact that North Star happened before Central was because North Star kind of got things done a little bit quicker than the line to St. Paul, because there were some, first it was going to be along the river, the St. Paul corridor. So that's what we're looking at. On the operating cost side, we think, as the County Transit Improvement Board, that these funds for the sales tax ought to be used for system improvements. That's what we advocated for them for, that the Met Council is responsible for the operating side of this, and we're supportive of finding ways to accommodate them and deal with their operating deficit, but to use the capital money that we told the voters in our district when we voted for the sales tax that it was going to be to improve the system, to think that those should be going for basic operating costs right now, we think is not the direction to go, and that another solution can and should be found. So that's a little bit of a long answer there, Mr. Chairman.
No, an important question, so thank you, Representative Chairman. I'll call on Representative Rodall, and then members, I would like to have Commissioner McLaughlin finish his presentation. Hopefully, you know, if you have questions, we can get those done quickly, but we have an important bill that I'd like to get to, and
Mr. Chair, if I can just quickly clarify, I believe there was state money appropriated for the Northwest Busway at some point. So I think it wasn't used because you're still trying to decide what you want to do, but I think it needs to be said that the state did at one point appropriate money for that project.
Mr. Chairman, that's accurate, and a longer story about why it didn't happen.
Right, but to say there are no state money.
No, there hasn't been. We're not expending.
I know, but there has been state support for that corridor, and I think that needs to be said.
Thank you. Let's have Representative Erdahl, and then allow Commissioner McLaughlin to finish his presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Morrow tells me it's my turn today on this topic. But Commissioner McLaughlin, you referenced Bottineau, Hiawatha, North Star, Central, the East Metro, and about geographic equity. From my standpoint, there's one area that's missing, and that's the West Metro. And of course, I think last year, maybe 2 years ago, I mentioned it to you, and we have since in statute identified the Little Crow line to the west, you know, 394 Bowen Highway 12, and certainly want you to have an eye toward that in the future and recognize that there is such a possible corridor established, and we are working to raise its visibility.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's Representative Verdahl, I think it's fair to say that you and Representative Junkie burned that impression into my forehead, and and I'm happy to say that Representative Hausman and I had a discussion of it earlier this week, and so the discussion continued. The fact that it's been named, the fact that there's now work being done to prepare for it, that's what it takes to get these things going. These are incredibly complicated undertakings, and so to get started and to start figuring out how you're going to put the pieces together is what you need to do, and I'm happy to be supportive. And we're trying, again, we haven't come to the long-term financial plan, and we're going to have to figure that out, and that's what we're going to be working on this year.
Thank you.
So we also made a grant, $950,000 grant from the special 1% guarantee that went to all counties. That went to Washington County, and they funded two things. We allowed them to fund the Forest Lake Express Bus operations to Minneapolis and the new one to St. Paul, and we allowed them to fund a study at the I-94 East transit options, essentially from St. Paul east through Woodbury and on to the border. So those, we made accommodation for the condition that Washington County was in terms of development of projects, and responded to their need for continued funding for the Forest Lake Express Bus. The other thing that and a number of you participated in this event at the University of Minnesota, we had what we call the Speed Up Conference. We had broad participation from folks across the region. It was initiated by the County Transit Improvement Board, and the co-sponsors were, in addition to the County Transit Improvement Board, the University of Minnesota Metropolitan Consortium, and the Metropolitan Council. And some of the things that we learned was that from the outside experts, what we were looking at, there are regions like Denver and Phoenix and Dallas and other places that are actually developing multiple lanes at one time rather than a largely serial development, one big line at a time. So we said, how'd you do it? And so we had a day-long event, and we learned a number of things. They suggested that this region, they were surprised at the relative lack of use of what is called small starts and very small starts, so the categories of federal funding for transit investment. They thought we could make much better use of those than we had previously. They thought that our use of formula funds from the federal government through CMAQ and STP could also be stronger and more aggressive in pursuing these lines. They saw, back to Representative Champion's comments, a weak connection between land use and transit development so far in this region, that needs to be enhanced. And they suggested that we have a program of projects, again, multiple projects that we're pursuing at one time rather than largely serial development, one project at a time. So that was their recommendation to us. Again, our next steps are a long-range financial plan to make sure that we use the resources that you authorized us to create, and we created through our imposition of the sales tax. We're going to have a strong plan that makes sense, leading to a long-range investment framework. We're going to be seeking federal authorizations in the new authorization bill and federal appropriations, as the counties and county rail authorities have done for more than a decade. And then there'll be another round of grants that will be probably in late 2009 or 2010. Mr. Chairman, I want to thank this committee and the legislature for entrusting the counties with this responsibility. I think we've been conservative in that we've set up a lean and mean organization. We've been conservative in our financial projections so that we're not running short, even in the face of this economic crisis that we're facing. And we've been conservative in that we're using cash now until we can get a firm, long-range plan that we can use to enhance transit in the metropolitan area. So we're looking and talking with other counties beyond the metropolitan area to see how the fingers can reach out into greater Minnesota as well. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to stand for other questions if you like.
Thank you. And I want to thank you again, Commissioner McLaughlin, and this entire CTIB board. You've done a lot in a very short amount of time, and I think are charting a very positive course for the future of the region and transitway development. Members, I'll take maybe one more question, but I would like to get to House File 116 next. So, are there any additional questions that members have of Commissioner McLaughlin? Going once, going twice. thank you very much again.
Members,
and again, members, this was by statute a required report, and I know that they've completed it in the Senate, so we look forward to hearing more as this effort progresses. A slight change in the agenda, members. We do have quite a bit of interest in House File 116. We have people that have traveled from greater Minnesota to be here, and a lot of interest in the public. We'll give this its due, as much time as we need. If it's possible that we still have some time in the end, we'll do the rural transit update at that point. Otherwise, we'll postpone that and hear that in the near future. And my apologies to MnDOT staff in advance if that ends up being the case. But we do have a lot of interest in the public on this bill, so we'd like to get to it. And I'll just let the author and the testifiers know again. We have about 45 minutes. It's really my intention to begin and end these meetings on time. If we do need a few extra minutes, we'll take those, but certainly not much after 2:30. So please keep your comments concise and crisp with that in mind. And I will move Representative Ward's bill, House File 116. Referral to the K-12 Education Policy Committee. That's the proper motion, and I'm making that on behalf of House File 116. Representative Ward, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for the opportunity today. It's one of those days that I'm going to give you an opportunity to make a real positive difference in our children today. So, that's a very important bill, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about it today. This House File 116. This last session, legislation was passed. I'm State Representative John Ward, and my testifiers will be going one at a time. And as soon as I'm done introducing the bill, last session legislation was passed, which addressed safety issues surrounding the Type 3 school vehicles and drivers. Probably most of you have received calls from your school districts regarding this bill since its passage last session. This last session's legislation came about as from a report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, which had concerns about the Type 3 school vehicle driver's requirements. Last session, the legislation required that drivers comply with a number of requirements, including a physical and drug test. The previous authors of the bill, Representative Bigham and Senator Olsen, intended to exempt school employees who are temporary or incidental drivers, Type 3 school vehicle drivers, from the requirements of the physical and drug testing through language which referred to, quote, normal duties in the previous legislation. However, the term normal duties was interpreted by the Department of Public Safety differently than the legislative intent of the authors. The Department of Public Safety's interpretation requires school districts to have anyone who may possibly drive a Type 3 vehicle meet these requirements, even though as regular school district employees, many of the requirements had already been met by regular employment with the school districts. This placed a significant financial hardship on many of the school districts in the form of an unfunded mandate. Now, we don't want to lose the intent of the bill also as far as the safety of our children. This bill was passed. As many remember, we had a terrible tragedy with a young lady by the name of Amanda Berglund in Forest Lake, who her and the driver of the Type 3 van were killed in an accident. And the Office of Legislative Auditor, as they reviewed this, that found that, in fact, the requirements, the concern of the requirements, needed to be addressed to protect the safety of our children. The intent was never to place a financial hardship on the schools or an unfunded mandate. House File 116 attempts to fix this problem while still protecting the safety of our children. It will bring back to law the original intent of the authors by requiring that anyone who is employed for the sole purpose of driving a Type 3 vehicle must meet all of these requirements. And again, anybody hired or is employed for the sole purpose of driving a Type 3 vehicle must meet all the requirements. I want to walk you through just some of the changes of House File 115 as compared to the bill last year. And I'm hoping that you have the bill in front of you, House File 116, and yeah, just address some of the changes that are in the bill. Mr. Chair, do you have the bill? Do the members
everyone should have the bill in their packets. If not, please let the page know. Okay, you can proceed, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first points I want to address, just clean up some small technical changes. In line 1.7, we've added A, B, and C type licenses to ensure that the highest class of licensure still can drive a Type 3 vehicle. In line 2.28, word changes are grammatical and there's not a substance change at all. It's just a grammatical kind of change. There have been some changes to the training language in the path of the station. On line 2.10 and 2.11, addition of training on compliance with paragraph K concerning reporting certain convictions to the employer within 10 days of conviction was added because we felt that if we were going to ask employees to take this action, in other words, to report within 10 days of conviction, a DWI or things as such, that they should be made aware of that during the training phase. So that's a pretty simple add as well. We also through the work group this summer, revamped the pre-trip inspection report to be more streamlined and easier to complete. Now I need to address bringing back the bill to its original intent of the authors. Lines 2.19 through 2.22. This new language ensures that a pre-employment drug and alcohol test is administered to new drivers. The Department of Public Safety has indicated that the old language did not ensure this, hence new and improved language. And then lastly, Mr. Chair, members, paragraph O, the real glitch in the bill from last year. This is the main reason for this year's bill. The Department of Public Safety indicated that old language did not exempt teachers and coaches or school employees due to the phrase normal duties. This new language, who is not, and I quote, who is not employed for the sole purpose of operating a Type 3 vehicle, is exempt from paragraphs E and F, gets us back to the original intent. It solves the problem of physicals at the deaf school, and you're going to hear about that in just a minute. And I want to add one more to that, to the physical part of it. I have a teacher in one of my school districts, Mike Olley, who is the choir director, and he's also the golf coach. Mr. Olley has severe diabetes, and a few years ago had his legs amputated and has prosthesis. As the Crosby School District was going through the process of certifying and training and physical and all the aspects of the Type 3 vehicle as it stood last year, Mike went through all of the training, and as it got to the part where he had to take the physical, they said, no, you wouldn't pass the physical, so you can't qualify to drive a Type 3 vehicle. Mike has been a teacher for over 30 years, a golf coach for that number of times, and here was a thing that just kind of blew me away. They also then went on to say, however, you can pursue a school bus endorsement and drive a school bus, which didn't make a lot of sense to me. So we have some physical needs that were unforeseen in the intent last year as well, and you're going to hear from one of the schools that it impacted greatly. It's going to bring the cost down to the school district, so we'll ensure that a teacher and coach will still have their license reviewed annually, and that's very important. So that if they get a DUI in the last year, the district will become aware of that. It also ensures that districts won't cut programs such as debate because the Type 3 law raised the cost too high. And that's what school districts were looking at, and that's what you probably heard from your school district. If we have to pay for this, we're going to have to cut extracurriculars, we're going to have to cut staff, we are not going to have the educational opportunities available to our children that have been available in the past. And that's what will happen if we have this unfunded mandate to our Type 3, to our school districts. So it's a very good fix, in my opinion. The last thing we want is a district to either cut the program, or even worse, tell students that they are to start driving themselves to their events and their meets. So, having said all that, Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to have three people testify today.
Representative Ward, before you do that, I wanted to just see if there were any preliminary questions from the committee. I know that Representative Erdahl has one. Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ward. Now, as I remember back on this bill and the debate that we had, apparently there are unintended consequences of what we were told in that debate. And much as it pains me to say this today, but Representative Heidgerken was right. As I recall, Representative Heidgerken was the only one to vote against this bill. I think it was, or maybe a couple others, I think it was only one. And he made the point that this was going to adversely affect the school districts, that you would have coaches not being able to drive. And so I'm very glad, and that's why I signed on to this bill, after hearing from athletic directors and superintendents that we make these changes and enable it to go back to at least to address that bad part of the bill. So that said, I'm guessing you're going to probably have 134 yes votes with this fix when it hits the floor. So just kind of as a minority member here, I'm suggesting that we could speed this up pretty good.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I comment?
Ward, a quick comment, and then let's get to your testifier.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Erdahl, thank you for that, and we all miss Representative Heinrich, and I want you to know that.
No.
Mr. Chair, I have three testifiers today, Allison Porter, and then Jan Alswager and Tom Dean, and then I have a number of other organizations that want to just say that they're in support of this legislation. So, Allison Porter is the first testifier, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much for your introductory comments. Ms. Porter, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate you letting me testify for this important bill. And thank you, Representative Ward, for authoring this bill. My name is Allison Porter. I'm from the Minnesota North Star Academy. It's my third year there. And I want to talk about how Type 3 driving requirements have impacted me and other students at North Star. We have about 35 high school students in total. In the past, we had cooking and transition classes, and the teachers could drive us to the grocery store or to where we needed to go. But now they can't. Now they also can't use the vans to drive us to games in other states so our team can play against other deaf teams. Now we have to rent a bus to drive us to our games or to go on field trips to our transition classes and any other school events. But now we can't go because of these new driving requirements. So that means no class field trips because our teachers are deaf. My school's gym does not have a full court, so we need to go to other schools to practice. In the past, the teachers could drive us to the YMCA to practice, so we could use the full court, but now they can't because our coaches are deaf. So we're limited to practice in the small gym at our school, and it's just not good for us. This has been really hard for the students and me and the coaches, the teachers, and the parents, and also very expensive for my school. So I'm hoping you will consider changing the Type 3 driving requirements so our coaches and teachers can drive us, and we can have class field trips again, and we can go to the YMCA to practice. And I want to let you know that it's not just my school that's been affected by this law. And so I'd like to share some of the issues faced by my deaf friends at the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf in Faribault. This law has reduced our ability to go on field trips, to go to job sites for work study, or participate in after-school or evening activities. Trips have been canceled, and staff have been pulled from their regular duties to drive. And overtime is being paid. And just attempting simple activities creates big headaches. There's about 65% of our staff are deaf, and they are wonderful role models for us students. We all can communicate in our native language, American Sign Language. And students and staff, we all understand each other. The school has been serving deaf children for over 140 years. And our deaf staff are there to show us that we can do anything except hear. So it's humiliating for the staff to have to depend on other hearing staff members to drive. It makes them appear inferior, and they are not. We can promise you that their driving records are excellent. This law was intended to improve safety, but for us students in our environment, it hasn't. It has simply made the daily activities at MSAD more difficult. It's ironic that 16-year-olds, we can get our driver's license and drive ourselves to a work-study site, but we can't be driven by a deaf staff member. What's wrong with this picture? We realize that this law was not intended to be discriminatory to the deaf, but this is what it feels like. So we ask you to please support House File 116 so we can get back to full operation of our programs and our activities. Thank you for your time listening to my comments.
Thank you very much, Ms. Porter. And are there any questions from the committee? Okay. We very much appreciate your coming and representing your school so well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Ward, I think I see...
Mr. Chair, I'd like to now call Jan Altschlager and Tom Dean down, please.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Altschlager.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jan Altschlager, Education Minnesota. I'd like to thank Representative Ward for bringing a... bill forward that fixes some problems in a very smart fashion. I'll keep my testimony very brief. The bill last year was worked on in a bipartisan manner. It's a spirit of cooperation type bill, but with these unintended consequences, it has put some hardships on school districts and some of our Education Minnesota members. We think that because of the review of the licensure and the driving records, it continues to keep safety at the forefront. We're concerned about the extra cost. In addition to the coaching type issues that you've heard about, in the previous testifier spoke about, there's issues too at a school, let's say an elementary school, where a child suddenly gets sick. And it is in the best interest of everyone if that child goes home, it's necessary. And the parents who's at home may not even have a vehicle, and it's necessary at times to transport these kids. That's something that you wouldn't normally think about. We always think about the coaches, et cetera. But there are other situations that you can't always predict. And so we think that this language makes a lot of sense, and specifically lines 3.18, 3.19 is the language that we are supporting. And again, we thank Representative Ford and your consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Altschlager. Are there questions for Ms. Altschlager from the committee? Thank you. And you're welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair,
your name for the record.
My name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel for the School Board Association. I think that in the past testimony, you've heard the situations that this applies to, you know, whether it's getting taken over to debates or somebody being run down to a tournament or whatever. These things were all intended to be grandfathered in last year when this bill passed. This one does pick up some additional safety requirements. You have new training requirements. You've got new reporting of convictions requirements. You've got an annual license verification. The key piece, as Ms. Allschwager pointed out, is in the language on 318 and 319. This is language that was proposed by the State Patrol. We support this language and we support this legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Deans. Any questions for Mr. Deans? Thank you. I believe we have some additional testimony. We have Captain Ken Urquhart.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Yes, Representative Ward.
Captain Urquhart was going to be available for questions, but he may, if he wants to say a word, he can say a word, obviously.
Okay. We just have him here as a testifier, so.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Ken Urquhart, and I'm the captain of the State Patrol, and I was before you last year to answer questions about the Type 3 school bus legislation. And once again, if you have questions, I'd be more than happy to answer those. Okay.
Thank you, members. Questions for the captain? Yes, Representative.
Mr. Chair, maybe as long as you got you up here, you might as well go on tape whether or not you support the bill or not.
Mr. That's Chairman, members, that you put me in a difficult position because I haven't gotten that direction from the administration, so I can make myself available for questions.
So previous testimony that said that you help prepare this bill, is that not correct? Or
well, we were invited to several meetings by the Senate author and not other meetings, and he met with a number of these constituency groups, and the concern was boiled down to the issue of the physicals, the cost, and of course the qualification of drivers and or the drug and alcohol testing requirements. And a number of folks that were involved in that process were offering different pieces of language, and this was one of those. The language here was part of this language was one of the things that was put on the table, and the author made a decision about whether or not to use that. That wasn't our commitment. It was the author's choice to use that language.
Representative Holder.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm almost sad I asked the question at this point because I really rely on your organization. It's your responsibility to make sure school buses, et cetera, are safe, and so. Do you oppose the bill? Can you say that or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbert, as some of the folks previously testified, there's a number of things here that strengthens the safety of the transportation of kids, where they talk about additional training, the license verifications for these school employees, the drug and alcohol testing improvement, reporting convictions, and why that is important is because most school employees, when they are hired, get a background investigation, a one-time occurrence. And if you're hired 20 years ago, you know, some of these school employees develop history. And so it's important for them to have the responsibility to come back to their employer or that school administration and say, hey, I got in trouble last week when I was in Las Vegas, and you need to know that. So it could put them in a very delicate position if they're transporting kids or they're exposed to children. And that was, and of course, the challenge with the hearing impaired folks and those schools. Amanda was actually coming from one of those schools and was being transported to her home in Forest Lake, where I live. And so we were well aware of that. And I think it was oversight on the part of the folks that were involved in the original legislation that there wasn't consideration there, and that was brought to everyone's attention during the interim. And of course that was a significant challenge because for a normal school bus driver that has an endorsement to drive the yellow school bus, there's a waiver process in place in the law. There is no waiver process in place as of today for a Type 3 school bus driver. So if they didn't qualify, there was no ulterior method to allow them to drive through a waiver process. So that was a real challenge. So as you can see, there was a number of issues here that a lot of the groups were trying to deal with. And a lot of different types of language were offered, and we just happened to, my comment was, if you want to exempt certain people, then I think you need to do that directly. And the issue of normal duties, of course, was got very complicated because we were inundated with requests from the industry about how do you interpret this? Because we interpret it this way. How does the department interpret it? And our interpretation was that if you were expected to drive children in a Type 3 as part of your duty, an expectation, and it was scheduled or expectation, then we felt that you needed to comply with all those requirements. If it was an unexpected trip, like a child gets sick and has to be taken home, we didn't feel that that was normal duty because it wasn't scheduled, it wasn't expected. So that terminology became a real problem in the existing law that is in place today.
Thank you, Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too wondered, we very often do ask the State Patrol specifically when we have an issue like this, and we usually get a very definitive answer, yes or no. So I've been sort of trying to read between the, or hear, listen between the lines. Did you support or oppose last year's bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we actually, as the department, prefer the existing law as it is today, which would have been last year's legislation. And we had that discussion with the author in the Senate about that early on. And, of course, like I talked about earlier, there's a number of challenges that go along with that with different groups. But that was our position.
Thank you. Members, are there any other questions of the captain? If not, is there anyone from the public who is not? This concludes our those who asked in advance to testify on the bill or comment on it or be available to comment on it. I wanted to see if there was anyone else from the public who is not on the list who wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to House File 116. Anyone else in our room today? Okay, with that, members, are there any other questions or comments, or do you have a very brief summation, Representative Ward? Oh, yes, we have one more question from Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward, hearing the comments from the patrol, are you considering any amendment or changing or to address their concerns?
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Leader. We feel that the language that we have presented today is the best language that we can come up with, agreeable for all parties involved and for the safety of our children. And at this point in time, I have no intent of offering another amendment. I've been in communication with Captain Urquhart, as we progress with this, that might be a possibility, but as of today, the language that we present is the language that we think feels best.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair,
then we'll wrap up.
Is it still going to the floor? Or is it
members, there is one more policy committee that will take a look at this, and that's the K-12 Education Policy Committee. So what I would suggest, if there are concerns such as the one that Representative Leader outlined, there will be another full committee of this legislature taking a look at this. That's Representative Mariani's committee. And I think looking at the bill, I would imagine it would have to go to public safety as well. So looks like there'll be two more opportunities to address concerns. So with that, members, I think we've wrapped up our discussion and debate of House File 116. And if the author has no additional comments, I will just simply renew my motion to pass and return this bill to the Transportation Finance Committee with a recommended re-referral to the K-12 Education Policy Committee. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you and congratulations, Representative Ward, and we will see you in the Education Policy Committee. Members, and thank you for the public for your interest in this bill. And members, it looks like we will have an opportunity to hear from MnDOT's rural transit staff, and we will spend about 15 minutes on this, and if there are some additional questions that we can't get to in the presentation, we'll save those for another day. So,
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
While they're setting up, if I could, I believe is the motion correct? You made the motion to go to Transportation Finance and then to Public Safety. I don't know if you can make a motion to go to more than one place.
The motion, I think, was to K-12 education policy. Representative Davis, that's a good question, and while our friends from MnDOT are setting up, I wanted to... Okay. What we're doing here, because we're a division of the Transportation Finance Committee, is that we do have to, it was re-referred, it came down to us from finance.
Let's go back.
We need to re-refer it back there, and then we have just a very short motion and Representative Leaders Committee to formally move it on to the E-12 policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And for the benefit of members, I am working with our leadership and to see if we can streamline these processes a little bit. This is kind of the same protocol we used last year, and I'm very much hoping that we can not have that extra perfunctory motion, and hopefully with some additional bills coming before us this year, we'll take care of that. But
we wish you all the luck.
So thank you. Thank you. We're working on it. So I appreciate the support of the committee for that. Okay, we are now starting our final agenda item, and I'd like to call on Mike Schadauer, and please correct me if I'm wrong on that pronunciation, to give us an overview of MnDOT's transit functions. And members, this will conclude our overview. We have really three main public entities that our committee is engaged with on transit, and that is MnDOT, Met Council, and the CTIB board that you heard from earlier. So this will conclude our series of overviews on transit from the public sector. So welcome to the committee. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, committee members. I'm Mike Schadauer. I'm the director of the Office of Transit at MnDOT, and we're the Office of Transit, not the Office of Rural Transit. We take care of all of the transit needs of greater Minnesota outside the metropolitan area of the Twin Cities. I also have with me Tom Gottfried, because I am fairly new to this. You might have known my predecessor, Donna Allen, who retired last year, so we'll see how long I can hang before you ask the question that I need help with. The mission of our office is to help people and communities meet their mobility needs, and I will cut it off there and cut off some of the other comments so that we can try to get through this in the 15 minutes. We are located within MnDOT in the Division of Modal Planning and Program Management, so we're grouped with the other modes of aeronautics and rail, freight and vehicle, commercial vehicle operations in MnDOT. We take care of many things across the state relative to mobility outside of the highway world. Again, we are responsible for transit in the 80 counties outside the metro area. We help those transit systems with rules and guidance and help them comply with regulations, and in particular federal regulations that are quite complicated for some of the smaller transit operations. We help manage the transit investment, and some of the ways we make that known to you is through our annual transit report that will be coming out in the next week or so and be distributed widely. We apply for federal funds and pass that on to the transit agencies across greater Minnesota. We provide technical assistance that entails helping with service design, helping with vehicle procurement, which is done centrally for the whole state. We help with routing, scheduling, and performance evaluations of systems to keep them as efficient as possible. We're also involved greatly with planning and research in the transit, bicycle, and pedestrian areas. The bicycle and pedestrian section is a part of the Office of Transit. So we've done a lot in the ways. Making sure bicycle and pedestrian facilities are part of transportation projects. We are working on several plans, some of which I'll get into in a little bit more detail here in a minute. Transit in greater Minnesota is used by about 11.3 million people in the last year. That's our estimate for 2008. And that's about almost 9% over what was over the number of trips in 2007. The trip purposes are for a variety of issues. A lot of our customers are people that don't have a choice of using a car, so there's a lot of use for medical trips. But it ranges for all of the kinds of purposes that people use transit anywhere. Commuting, getting to school, getting to shopping. A lot of the trips that we serve now
let me rephrase that, a lot of trips could be added to what we serve now because several of our transit operations are constrained to the number of hours they can serve because they simply don't have enough money to provide service in a longer time frame. Our systems range in size from the system in Duluth that has, I believe, over 80 buses, down to some systems that have as few as one bus. They might be operated directly by people that are employed by the recipients of our state and federal funds, or they might contract out for transit drivers. And we use a variety of buses across the state. The bulk of them are usually smaller ones of a 17 to 25 passenger size, and every single vehicle that is procured through our office for any of the state transit systems are all accessible completely with a lift or a ramp. There are 61 different transit systems in greater Minnesota, and you can see the breakdown of 12 multi-county ones, the largest being Arrowhead, which serves an area of northeast Minnesota that's larger than some states. And we also have 23 municipal systems, and that includes the six larger systems in the larger cities of Duluth, St. Cloud, Rochester, Moorhead with Fargo, East Grand Forks with Grand Forks, and the La Crosse-La Crescent area. Those provide regular and special service for disabled or elderly passengers. There's also one reservation, the Red Lake Reservation, that has transit service. Right now we're working on a transit plan for greater Minnesota. The purpose of that is to determine the future demand, and we've been working from something that has an estimate of that. We're basically trying to make sure that that's an accurate estimate of demand and carry that into the future. We'll talk about that in a minute. We're trying to provide a vision and strategy for transit delivery across the state and make sure that cost-effective and efficient service is provided. We held outreach meetings back in September of last year across the state. We also have a steering committee that helps us with this project. We have a report that's going to be drafted and ready for review in April of this year, just a couple months from now, with a final report due in May. And then right on the heels of that, we'll begin work on the implementation plan, which will basically take the results of this Greater Minnesota Transit Plan and define how we deliver the service that can help us reach the goal. Some of the trends that we've noted while we're going through the plan include some of the demographics. Minnesota's population is aging, as I'm sure you're well aware. We're also seeing a lot of retirees migrating to rural areas, like the Northern Lakes areas, and see a great influx of immigrants to rural Minnesota, especially Hispanic and Somali populations around the state. Some other trends that we've noted and taken into account as we work on the plan is the travel patterns around the state. There are a great number of people now that live in one county and work in another. There's a lot of consolidation of facilities, whether they be health facilities, school facilities, or educational facilities, and that changes the way people need to travel. And then there's some other issues like the higher fuel costs we experienced last year that have a bad effect on several people that make transit their only option. We're trying to take that all into account, and that's part of what you'll see in the outcome of that transit plan. As far as the service in greater Minnesota, this map shows all the counties that have countywide service by the green shading. The number of counties that are served are one of our performance measures, and right now we're at 68 counties with our contracts that we're putting out for calendar year 2009 that have countywide service. That doesn't necessarily mean they have service every day. It does mean that they have service at least some point every week.
Mr. Shatter. Just a very quick question on this, the trend issues. We talk about the concentration of services in the regional centers, but it's my understanding that, I know this is the case for Rochester, and I'm guessing it is for St. Cloud too, significant population increases projected over the next couple of decades. Do you also view that as a trend in your planning?
Absolutely, and I didn't bother showing all the different trends we're identifying, but there are places like Rochester where the population is growing. There are other parts of the state where the county's populations are shrinking. And we've heard loud and clear from several counties how important transit is to maintain the employers in some of those counties so that they can continue to be an economically viable county. So there are a lot of trends outside the ones that I've specifically listed here that are very important to the transit
situation in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Just to wrap up the slide with the counties that have service, we also identified the 7 counties that have only municipal service, at least 5 counties across the state that have no service at all after we implement the services this year. This year, 2009, we'll see Canandaigua get service for the first time as a county. I talked a little bit about the transit demand across the state. This graph gives our best effort at trying to make sense of what that means. There's a diagonal line on this graph that represents our goal of trying to achieve 80% of the needs being met. And then the bar lines that try to reach up towards that diagonal line illustrate how much we've been able to supply as far as transit service. So the terms that we're using here are millions of hours of bus hours. You can see that for 2009, our estimate of that goal is that 1.35 million hours of vehicle service hours would be needed to meet 80% of the demand. And we're going to be providing about 1.03 million hours of service in 2009. In other words, we're reaching about 75% of our goal, or 63% of the entire need for the state. You can also see on the chart that we project the number of service hours we'll be able to provide over the next 2 years. What that illustrates is a flat line right now, basically because the motor vehicle sales tax is not growing the way we were hoping it would. So we're going to be at a fairly stable level for the next several years because of the growth of the percentage that's allowed for Greater Minnesota Transit. That percentage is going up while the pie is growing smaller, so we basically kind of stay at the same level of service that we can provide after you take into account.
And Mr. Cotter, I do have a question from Representative Morrow, who has really been a champion of rural transit, and I think just as Representative Rudolph has mentioned the Little Crow line, and we know about the importance of that, we also know that Nicollet County is one of those counties that doesn't have service, and so represent well.
And Mr. Chair, I wasn't even going to mention that. And we had a chance to talk in the hallway, so I just want to make sure the members are clear with my concern of the $1 million cut that we talked about in transportation finance yesterday. Members, if you look at this chart, meeting Greater Minnesota need, by 2012, we'll be meeting 55% of the total need for transit in Greater Minnesota along these projections. I want to remind members, this line is 80% of the need. So that was the difference of the numbers that Mr. Shadower and I had yesterday. What he was talking about, 80% of the need, I'm talking about total need. We'll be meeting about half the total need in about 4 years, or 3 years under this projection.
Chair Representative Moreau, that's correct. That's what this chart illustrates.
Okay. Members, I think what I'd like to do is have Mr. Shadower do as much as you can here, and then we will still plan to end our meeting on time, but we are going to be talking about the rail plan next time, and I think if there's some additional questions, it's possible for you to come back, or some additional ideas you'd like to share with us that you couldn't get to today, that might be an appropriate time to do it, because it's not the exact thing, but it's somewhat related. So if you could just do as much as you can here in the next couple of minutes, and then we'll see if we can have you back, because this is a very, very important topic, and I don't want to give it short shrift.
Sure,
so you can proceed.
Thank you. This chart illustrates the difference in funding that Greater Minnesota Transit will receive from the state in the biennium that just ended and the biennium that we will be getting into starting in state fiscal year 2010. This reflects the approximately $300,000 unallotment of funds for Greater Minnesota Transit in fiscal year 2009 and the $1.9 million reduction in general fund that's been proposed for 2010 and 2011 that was referred to by Representative Moreau. You can see that the increase between the two biennials will be about $11 million in state funds. Now, this is just a portion of the funds that Greater Minnesota Transit receives. We also receive federal funds, and local communities also provide funds for their transit operations. But I do want to illustrate that even though this is a quite a bit larger number, the inflation costs that transit incurs and the fact that the federal funds are not expected to grow and the local funds aren't going to grow very much leads us to that fairly stable number of 1.03 million hours of service that we would expect to provide over the next several years. The contracts that we put out for this calendar year, 2009, are summarized on this slide, where we're using $10.4 million of federal funds, approximately $16.1 million of general funds, state funds, and $14.1 million of motor vehicle sales tax state funds. They get combined with the required local match of $8.6 million to come up with our approximately $49 million worth of contracts for this year. I do want to emphasize that the local governments provide far more than their minimum local share. This is the contractual requirement. We also were able to do several things in the way of capital assistance for transit systems across the state. This slide illustrates the amount of federal and state funds that became available for capital work, and then it also illustrates the local funds that were put forth. So about $18.3 million over the biennium of 2008-2009 went into capital improvements for the transit program. Some of those facilities that got built are illustrated on this slide with the recent bonding that's been made available from the state. The 2006 bonding of $2 million for Greater Minnesota Capital went towards several garage or transit facilities across the state. The $1 million in 2008 went towards a couple of garages across the state. And I think I'll be able to finish, Mr. Chair, because...
Okay. If you want to finish your slides, that's okay. It is 2:30, so I would like to break, you know, in a minute or two. But I know there are other questions, and I know that this topic is very, very important. And it's my intention that we continue this hearing next week, at least for another few minutes. Members, please come with your questions about Greater Minnesota Transit. I think Representative Morrow's point about need is a good one. I know that there's some outstanding funding questions that I think really do need to be addressed, and so we'll definitely take some time to do that next Wednesday. But if you want to just make some concluding comments, at least for today, and then I'll let the committee know what else we're doing next week, and then we'll adjourn. So continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to mention that we do provide a lot of aid for the procurement of vehicles for elderly and disabled transit service across the state. It's done through the Section 5310 federal program. It helps people with disabilities, the elderly, to get to their medical appointments, stopping, etc. It's operated by a variety of nonprofit organizations or public bodies, tribes, and they use small to medium vehicles for this. So there's 129 different organizations across the state that have received vehicles through this program. In 2008, they received just about $1.8 million through these programs. It's an 80-20% program. They can also apply for a relatively new program called New Freedom to get grants to help with providing transit above and beyond what the Americans with Disabilities Act requires. I won't get into the passenger and freight rail plan because we'll hit that next week.
We'll take it from there next week. Members, just two quick things before we adjourn. I did want Representative Morrow to share with us, I think, an important question that's come up and one that we certainly want to address next week.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chatter, so when you come back next week, my understanding is that MnDOT contracts that you referenced earlier have been let late this year, and I've got some concerns about the cash flow problems for some of our transportation providers in Greater Minnesota. So when you return next week, I'd like to hear, does MnDOT know how many Greater Minnesota transit systems have been affected by the cash flow and the late payments, and what is MnDOT's plans for helping address those cash flow problems? Because what we're hearing in Greater Minnesota is that some of the transit providers are going to close their doors, or at least might. So I'd like to hear about that next week.
Thank you. That's a good transition to next week. Next week, members, and thank you very much, Sean Aaron. Sorry that we ran out of time, but we do appreciate your willingness to come back. Next week, we have, in addition to completing this hearing and having an overview of the state rail plan, and I think some questions about that, I will start next meeting with an important bill, Representative Portman's child restraint bill, next Wednesday. I'd like to take that bill first. And I appreciate the perfect attendance we had today. We've had some people coming and going. Some have come late. Some have left early. That's a natural thing. I would really encourage everyone to come and stay the entire hearing. I understand, though, you have constituents, et cetera. Just let Ms. Maher know if you're going to be late or if you need to leave early, because I want to get a sense of, you know, who's going to be here and when. But again, encouraging everybody to be here on time and expecting to stay for an hour and a half is my expectation. But again, if you do know that you're going to be late, even 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and you feel that you need to leave early, please let us know for the future. So with that, members, I adjourn our meeting, and we'll see you next Wednesday.